Lecture 14, Soviets and Nazis, Surveillance and Terror.
There you sit in your apartment, late at night. Outside, the city seems to be sleeping. But sleep does not come for you. These days have been so full of political turmoil, sudden changes in the party line, intrigue, and whispered news of friends or colleagues at work who have disappeared. Then in the street below, you hear the screech of brakes as cars pull up to the curb by the entrance to your building. Downstairs, car doors slam, and you hear the pounding of footsteps up the stairs, and then the banging of fists on the door. Is it your door? Is it a neighbor's door? You start hearing shouts of, "Police! Open up immediately!" Was it something that you said? Did the party representative in the building listen at your door as you made a joke? Who could have denounced you? A coworker? Maybe a relative? In this lecture, focused on Stalin's Soviet Union and Hitler's Nazi Germany, we want to discuss a topic that involves a different kind of spying, unlike the world of international espionage. This was the unprecedented spying on one's own subject population. In their different ways, the Soviets and the Nazis built a modern surveillance society of unprecedented intensity, taking internal espionage to a brand new level. And at the same time, both regimes justified this by claiming that this was a defense against foreign spies. They built up entire political myths around alleged outside threats to vindicate their own internal control. In the Soviet case, officials argued that there was an international capitalist conspiracy infiltrating the model new state and workers' paradise of the Soviet Union. In the Nazi case, deploying racist paranoia, Hitler and his followers constantly claimed that an international Jewish conspiracy was at work. In the process, they referenced that notorious forgery, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And they constantly invoked the formula of Judeo-Bolshevism to describe the Soviet Union, claiming that the Soviet Union was a Jewish state and part of an alleged global plan. Now, as we've already seen in prior lectures, there have been many instances of internal police observation of a population. Ancient Sparta, ancient Persia, the Oprichnina of Russia under Tsar Ivan the Terrible, the police of revolutionary France, and Napoleon's police forces. So these were precursors indeed. But what the regimes of the 1930s did was to take this to an entirely new level. How did they do this, and what was it like? In our present day, we too find ourselves under new kinds of surveillance all the time. Traffic cameras at intersections, security cameras at the bank and at ATM stations, and scores of other places. Thus, a history of surveillance and the potential for its abuse in the past is probably more necessary now than ever, given our present experience. Ironically, at the same time as international politics was heading toward a new world war in the 1930s, within the Soviet Union, instead of leaving everything else aside to prepare for international war, Stalin was instead waging what amounted to a war on his own country. By Stalin's strange logic, it was imperative to transform old Russia first by a revolution from above, to fundamentally change it, and then be ready for a war against the capitalists. Recall that Stalin had succeeded the original Bolshevik leader Lenin after he had died in 1924. By 1929, Stalin had created an undisputed position for himself as the supreme leader of the Soviet Union, the Vozhd, the leader, with a cult of personality that presented Stalin as the infallible, all-seeing, an omnipotent director of the fate of the Soviet Union. Lenin's body had been mummified, it lay in state in a mausoleum at the wall of the Kremlin, and Stalin presented himself as Lenin's successor and the high priest of the Lenin cult. In 1929, Stalin moved to bring agriculture under total state control. Part of this campaign, a deliberate outcome of it, was the so-called terror famine in Ukraine and other parts of the Soviet Union, which took place in 1932 to 1933, and saw some 5 to 7 million starving to death. Stalin also ordered a crash industrialization program put into effect in the Soviet Union, with tremendous dislocations as the result here as well. And there was a curious dynamic into how Stalin and his colleagues reacted to when these programs didn't yield the desired results. If Stalin and the party were not in error, then logically it must be someone else's fault. These failures in the economy or in industry were not failures of planning, they argued, but instead must be due to internal opposition and were proof of foreign infiltration, foreign spies, and saboteurs. Those who resisted or were suspected of resistance were meted out harsh fates. They were sent to gulag camps for forced labor, which were meant to re-educate, but often, in fact, were fatal. The names of these sites of suffering, of the gulag camps, are not widely known in the West, but they should be. Magadan, Vorkuta, Norilsk, Kolyma, Chelyabinsk, Karaganda, and many others. As had been the case under Lenin, the secret police were part of the campaign to remake the Soviet Union. The GPU was proud of its role in rooting out alleged internal traitors and spies. Stalin, for his part, actually admired the career of Napoleon's secret police chief, the slippery Fouché, whom we discussed in Lecture 7. And then he also had a Russian example to emulate, Ivan the Terrible. Stalin saw Ivan the Terrible as a progressive figure, a centralizer who had built up the Russian state and for that reason was admirable. Stalin saw the secret police as a vital tool of his own personal power. The police bureaucracy was also put under new management in this period. Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the CK, had died in 1926. He'd actually suffered a heart attack after giving a rousing, passionate speech in which he denounced Trotsky, Stalin's eternal rival. Upon his death, Dzerzhinsky was called by Stalin a knight of the proletariat. Others celebrated him as a sword of the revolution, recognizing his crucial role in enforcing Bolshevik rule. Years later, after the Second World War, in 1958, a 15-ton black statue of Iron Felix Dzerzhinsky was erected outside the Lyubyanka headquarters of the secret police in Moscow. With the fall of the Soviet Union, that huge statue would fall as well, pulled down by Muscovites from its pedestal in 1991. After the death of Dzerzhinsky, the OGPU was renamed yet again, the NKVD in 1934. NKVD stood in Russian for Narodny Komissariat Vnutrennykh Del, in English, the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs. It was at first under the leadership of the brutal police chief Genrikh Yagoda. Stalin gave to the NKVD the leading role in a new campaign of transformation in the Soviet Union, known as the Great Purge of 1936 to 1938, sometimes also called the Great Terror. The Great Purge or Great Terror saw over 600,000 people executed in the Soviet Union in the murder basements of the NKVD and their headquarters throughout the country, or in mass graves in the woods. Those mass graves are still being turned up today in the former Soviet Union. This purge was launched as a result of a mysterious murder of one of Stalin's potential rivals, Sergei Kirov, in December of 1934. And the murder of this party official is, to this very day, still surrounded in obscurity and mystery. Many believe that Stalin himself ordered the murder of this rival and then made a show of being upset. Stalin was shocked by this event, and then used it as a pretext to cleanse the party and country. The death of Kirov, he said, suggested that there was a massive internal conspiracy to eliminate the leaders of the Bolshevik Party, and for that reason, drastic measures needed to be taken. Massive arrests followed. The arrests targeted party officials, especially those who were not part of Stalin's own patronage network. They targeted old Bolsheviks, in particular those who had been old friends of Lenin, who might have been Bolsheviks even longer than Stalin himself had been, who might have traveled abroad or been in Swiss exile, and who thus had experiences that predated Stalin's own revolutionary lineage. Stalin had them eliminated as well. And then next came ordinary citizens of the Soviet Union, people who simply fell afoul of the secret police and the Bolshevik regime. In particular, we now know from more recent research, they also targeted ethnic minorities in the Soviet Union, in particular, the Polish minority, because they were judged to have ties or relationships with people outside the borders of the Soviet Union in independent Poland. The next stage in the purge was the Moscow show trials. There were three successive, massively publicized public trials in Moscow in 1936, in 1937, and in 1938. And these were reported on internationally. Row upon row of prominent communists were brought to trial and accused of plotting against Stalin. They gave improbable confessions. It was clear from the appearance of some of those who were on trial that they had been tortured. Some of those confessions also were clearly falsified. There were cases of leaders admitting to having met foreign agents who were their handlers in hotels in foreign countries. And it turned out afterwards those hotels had actually been demolished years before the alleged meeting, but this didn't really matter. It was the spirit of the thing that mattered. After giving their improbable confessions, these leaders were convicted and executed. Among those leaders was Zinoviev, the putative author of the Zinoviev letter that we mentioned in the previous lecture. In death, many of these purge leaders became non-persons. Just like Trotsky had been, they were expunged from the historical record. And in old photographs of Lenin's revolutionary days, suddenly there were a lot of empty spaces around him in photographs as they were airbrushed in order to remove these non-persons from the historical record. Next, it was a short step for Stalin to repeat something that the Bolsheviks had done already, to create their own internal anti-Bolshevik opposition. The Cheka, you'll recall, had created the so-called Trust in the 1920s. Stalin went further. He created an imaginary network of spies to serve as scapegoats for the failings of his own regime. This whole process of invention, of propaganda about an alleged spy network, was done from 1933 and then really began in earnest, went into overdrive in 1937 with a new chief for the NKVD secret police. Since September 1936, Nikolai Yezhov had started targeting an alleged spy network that they called the Polish Military Organization. Yezhov was a feared figure. He was formidable in spite of being quite diminutive in size, only about 5 foot tall, but he was feared throughout the country. Increasingly, as the purges accelerated, even secret police officials of the NKVD themselves were also arrested and executed as foreign agents. In the logic of Stalinism, this argument went as follows. If there was still a problem with spying at this late date, there must be a reason. And the reason must be that spies had infiltrated the NKVD secret police itself. In the next wave of those who were arrested was the recent director of the NKVD, Genrikh Yagoda. In summer of 1937, Stalin also moved to arrest tens of thousands of Red Army officers. 9 of 10 generals were eliminated in this purge, including great heroes of the Russian Civil War, like General Tukhachevsky. Military talent was savaged, and the military staff decimated, leaving the Soviet Union ill-prepared for the challenge of World War II that was just around the corner. The madness further had method. It was bureaucratically organized. quotas of numbers of people that were to be arrested, not names, but numbers, were sent out to police out in the separate regions. And those secret police chiefs would then compete to exceed their quotas. If you exceeded your quota, this showed that you were especially motivated and efficient. And this was a fatal rivalry as police chiefs competed against one another to see how many they could arrest. It would cost lives of innocent people. Family members of suspects could also be arrested as so-called enemies of the people, guilt by association. No one seemed exempt from the knock on the door in the middle of the night. Denunciations, which often were fatal, were encouraged in society generally. Let me give you a notorious example from Soviet propaganda. This was the boy hero, Pavel Morozov. He was actually enshrined in statues throughout the Soviet Union as a martyr to the state, a martyr to Stalin's leadership. According to state propaganda, the 12-year-old boy, who was a committed communist, at least according to this legend, had denounced his own family for hoarding food, hiding it from the state. And in revenge, relatives had hanged him for this treachery. Now, there was a real Pavel Morozov, and he was apparently killed, but the circumstances of the propaganda legend have been disputed most heatedly and don't really seem to match up with the facts of the case. That didn't matter to the state, which used him as an ideal. To the state, he was a model young man. Denunciations also took on a dynamic of their own. Jealous co-workers could use denunciations against colleagues as a form of upward mobility. If they aspire to the job of the person that they denounce, they might be able to move into that position after the secret police had taken their rival away. Similarly, having an apartment that other people might covet in a time of intense shortage of living space in the Soviet Union could also motivate someone to denounce you. In this pressure cooker of fear, a kind of coping mechanism evolved in the form of humor, in Russian anekdoty, anecdotes. Let me give you some examples. In one case, two prisoners are talking in a jail. One prisoner asks the other, "What is he in for?" The second prisoner replies that he's in for oversleeping. And the first prisoner is just astonished. He knew that it was easy to fall afoul of the state in the Soviet Union, but he didn't know that oversleeping was a crime. The second prisoner explains that he and a friend had been telling each other political jokes one night over vodka, and then the next morning his friend got up earlier than he did and made it to the secret police office first to denounce him. In another anecdote, a Soviet citizen goes to the NKVD office to denounce his own parrot. The parrot has escaped. Now, the secret police have been taking so many denunciations in these days that they're just exhausted, but they manage to remain polite and to take the report. And just before he leaves, the citizen says, one more thing. I just want to make very clear that I do not share my parrot's political opinions. The great writer George Orwell, who made a career of exposing and denouncing the trend of totalitarianism, wrote a very apt statement in which he said that every joke is a tiny revolution. Every joke is a tiny revolution, in itself an act of resistance. But think of how small against the force that is arrayed against an ordinary citizen. After the toll of the terror, Stalin called off the program for now in November of 1938, and he replaced the new NKVD chief Yezhov with Lavrenty Pavlovich Beria, who was a Georgian just like Stalin was and more trusted. Later, for symmetry's sake, he had Yezhov shot as well. So here was another former police chief of the NKVD who had been executed. Surveillance in the Soviet Union continued and, in fact, was institutionalized even after Stalin was gone, decades later, in a kind of figure, a distinctive kind of person that visitors to the Soviet Union will remember. This was the dezhurnaya, an older woman who was assigned to a hotel or dormitory or office building to keep watch, simply to sit there and observe comings and goings. Dezhurnaya means a woman who is on duty. The state as a whole was to be seen as constantly vigilant, unsleeping, watching, and on duty. Meanwhile, in Germany, the Nazis were building their own surveillance state at the same time. Driven by their racial and anti-Semitic obsessions, the Nazis claimed that here they were creating a new kind of society, a true people's community, Volksgemeinschaft in German, which would grow strong and regain for Germany its rightful position in the world. If the current state of Germany could be cleansed, in particular of racial enemies, it would be restored to greatness. The Nazis claimed, moreover, that their project was endangered by a global Jewish conspiracy, allegedly, and that a state of war already existed, even before war was declared. They saw themselves at war with the world. In a state of war, internal cohesion would be even more important, which meant subordinating everyone to the cause of one race, one Reich, and one Führer. Now, the Nazis said very, very many chilling things in their propaganda throughout their years of rule. But among the many chilling things they said, there's one that haunts me more than any other. And that's their declaration that in Nazi Germany, the era of personal happiness was now over. Everyone would have to be happy or miserable together. And it was the duty of German racial comrades to keep an eye on each other for that greater purpose. A secret police structure was also constructed to keep watch on society. There was also a more traditional-looking military intelligence bureaucracy, the Abwehr, that we'll discuss in lectures 16 and 17. Here I want to concentrate on the internal police in Nazi Germany. This secret police was part of a state within a state being built up by one of Hitler's closest associates, Heinrich Himmler. Himmler was a gray nothing of a man. He wore little spectacles, had a blank and very pale face. He was one of those quiet ones you have to look out for. He, moreover, was a failed chicken farmer who had joined the Nazi party early and had strange beliefs like his conviction that he was a reincarnated German medieval king. But he did have uncanny skills of organization and bureaucratic infighting. While the Nazis were still struggling to come to power, Himmler had been put in charge of the SS. This was Hitler's personal bodyguard, the Schutzstaffel, a black-uniformed elite to defend Hitler. In 1932, the year before the Nazis came to power, Himmler also formed another institution, the SD, or Sicherheitsdienst, the security service, as the party's own internal security agency. When the Nazis did come to power in 1933, Himmler began a long process that was completed by 1936 of slowly gathering to himself all control of all of the different German government police forces, especially the Gestapo, the secret state police. The following year after the Nazis came to power, 1934, Himmler and his forces were crucial in purging some of Hitler's own loyal followers, the stormtroopers, in the Night of Long Knives. And Stalin is said to have really admired this as a very effective action. Himmler's own empire grew further as a result. And in 1939, he capped his long process of acquiring governmental power, of gaining control over agency after overlapping agency, with the founding of a super agency, the RSHA, or Reichssicherheitshauptamt, the Reich Security Central Office, which was run by his protege, Reinhard Heydrich. The RSHA was in charge of all of the police forces and intelligence tasks to fight the enemies of the Reich. From the time they came to power in 1933, the Nazis used police power to clamp down on opposition as they sought to Nazify Germany. Arrested people were taken to concentration camps, whose existence was not hidden, as the existence later of the extermination camps in the East would be secret. Here, by contrast, the concentration camps were common knowledge. The Nazis wanted people to know about them in order to make explicit the threat that anyone who opposed the Nazis could end up there as well. Idle chatter or jokes could get you in trouble. Now, it's very interesting. I've talked about the tradition of anecdote in the Soviet Union. It's significant that there were lots of jokes in Nazi Germany as well, but very few jokes that have been recorded, at least, about Himmler or the Gestapo. The Gestapo pursued distinctive tactics. Someone who had been condemned to a concentration camp before 1939 often received a sentence not of years, but rather of weeks or months. And then, after being terrorized and brutalized, they might be sent out back into society to have a deterrent effect. One of the rare jokes that is recorded about the activities of the secret police in Nazi Germany involves a joke about a concentration camp. It involves a neighbor meeting another neighbor who he knows has just been released from a camp. The neighbor says, "That must have been terrible for you." The former inmate of the camp replies, "Oh, no, no, not at all. It was wonderful. We had breakfast in bed, sports before lunch, then a long nap, then a delicious tea was served, then a wonderful dinner, and after that, movies." The neighbor says, "Well, that's outrageous for me to hear that because it means I've been lied to. You know, our buddy Miller, he told me when he was released from the concentration camp that it had been terrible." And the former camp inmate replies, "Yes, and they took Miller away again yesterday." The terror was not hidden, but was meant to be well known and used to spread fear. The German secret police like to project an image of being a huge, monolithic, omnipresent force. But the reality was actually quite different, as records from the offices of the Gestapo testify. This is recent historical, more recent historical research that's been very revealing. There were only some 7,000 officials in the Gestapo and 5,000 in the security service, SD, before the war. So it was relatively small. The Nazi security apparatus also relied mostly not on agents who were infiltrated through the population, but on denunciations from the public, even more than active investigation on their part. Over half of the arrests made by the Gestapo depended on somebody denouncing someone else. And at times, the Gestapo offices, we know this from their records, were overwhelmed by waves of people denouncing each other in ways that the Gestapo couldn't deal with administratively. This was a source of enduring frustration for the Gestapo because it impeded their ideal of orderly administration. Himmler instructed his Gestapo that the German people must see the secret police in distinctive ways, as trustworthy, even as they were feared. In this way, Himmler argued, arrests would be seen as frightening, but well-deserved. Himmler said that the German people must come to see the Gestapo as men with human kindness, human hearts, and absolute rightness, as true servants of the German people. This is really a monstrous statement, but one that he passed along as advice. Recent research on the Nazi regime and its interaction with German society has lately moved away from the image of a German society completely terrorized into submission. Instead, this recent research stresses the way in which the Gestapo relied on help, on informants, on the cooperation of the population. Not everyone in the population, but enough cooperation. This research also stresses the way in which terror was selective, targeting mostly those who already had been defined as outsiders for racial reasons, as Jews, or for political reasons, as opponents of the Nazis, so that meanwhile the majority could feel itself to be largely safe and was available, in many cases, for complicity in self-policing. The 1930s in Europe were, as we've seen, a golden age of terror wielded by secret police, especially in Stalin's Soviet Union and Hitler's Germany. These regimes had radically opposed ideologies. They saw each other as moral enemies in a world historical struggle, and yet they had features in common. And in fact, in August of 1939, Hitler and Stalin showed their common interests by signing the Nazi-Soviet Pact. What a strange term to even consider. Nazi-Soviet Pact, which showed they could make common cause. The outcome of this was the Second World War, as they divided Poland and the Baltic states among themselves. Not least, the Soviets and Nazis both envisioned society not as a realm of free individuals, but saw societies in collective terms, as anthills of different kinds. A key aim of the terror that these states wielded, moreover, was to get people to police themselves. One last joke. As a joke in the Soviet Union put it, when true full communism had finally been achieved in the future, there'd be no more need for a secret police. People would have learned how to arrest themselves. The cases of Stalin's Soviet Union and Nazi Germany are part of a trend that we've seen before in these lectures and we'll see again later. Society's put under surveillance with attempts to read society, to peer into people's very hearts and minds. Later in these lectures, we'll see how in the United States, Senator Joseph McCarthy came to embody anxieties that the society had been infiltrated by communist influence. Public hearings were held in the United States to determine loyalty, and people were invited to denounce colleagues and friends. Later, communist East Germany would also set up a probably historically unprecedented level of intensive surveillance of its own citizens. At the very end of these lectures, we'll consider how much modernity itself is marked by surveillance society. But what made the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany distinctive was their intense use of surveillance, terror, and intense violence together to remake society and shape people's minds to the desires of the state. This question about what's going on in people's minds raises the question of what was going through the minds of those who were invited to become agents in the secret world of espionage and covert action for new ideological regimes. And those questions of motivation we'll turn to in our next lecture.